We'll wrap up the Barrows Lecture Series with one of the most accomplished ornithologists in the United States, Scott Wiedensahl. He's worked with hawks, owls, even hummingbirds, and we're really looking forward to his talk on Wednesday, May 11th. Scott Wiedensahl, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sam.
Now, you know, I think you might be most famous, or at least how I first learned about you, was your terrific book, Living on the Wind. Rare is a natural history book nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. So you certainly took the birding world by storm and really the literary world as well. I imagine that was really something, a successful book, eh?
It was, and it was also, as I have often told people, probably the most fun that I will ever have professionally in my life was writing that book. I mean, I've been a bird nut all my life, and I had the opportunity to spend, you know, a number of years basically traveling up and down the Western Hemisphere following bird migration, which is like getting paid to eat ice cream if you're a bird nut like me. So, yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity, and I'm actually going to be starting, here over the next couple of years, working on essentially a sequel to Living on the Wind. It's been almost 20 years since that book came out, mm-hmm. and I'd like to write about what we've learned in the intervening years about bird migration, sort of the mechanics of it, seeing the amazing things that birds do physiologically and with their navigation abilities, but also the conservation challenges that migratory birds are facing and some of the opportunities for conservation that we've got with and through migratory birds.
And certainly over that 20 years, gosh, with miniaturization, the ability of researchers to follow birds is the darndest thing I ever saw.
Well, that's the amazing part. And, it's something that I'm directly involved in as well. And because of that miniaturization, you know, we're able to put tiny little tracking devices on gray-cheeked thrushes in mm-hmm. the tundra of central Alaska and follow them on their migration to South America and back again, find out when they return the next spring exactly where they've been, you know, traveling down through Central America into the jungles of northern South America. Tiny little logging devices on seabirds, you know, that are, you know, Arctic terns that are traveling 51,000 miles a year, was just absolutely unheard of just a couple of years ago.
Now, I know you've written many other books, also written nature columns regularly for newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer, but you're not just a guy who's sitting at a computer. I know also you're renowned for your bird banding and research on raptors. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's really been fun. I got my start back in the mid-1980s. I grew up pretty close to where I live now in the mountains of Pennsylvania, close to Hawk Mountain Sanctuary, and started volunteering as a bander on their raptor banding project and just got completely engrossed in that whole, you know, what the great conservationist Aldo Leopold said, it was like buying a ticket to a great lottery, you know, putting a band on a bird's leg and not knowing whether or not that bird would be the one that's returned, you know, years later, starting to connect some of the dots on where they go. And, yeah, I got started with raptors and have been going steadily smaller ever since, mm-hmm. working with songbirds, you know, working with hummingbirds, very interested in the new migratory path that a lot of western hummingbirds are showing as they're evolving new wintering areas in the east, you know, rufous hummingbirds from Alaska and the Pacific Northwest wintering in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. And also very involved with owl research. For the last 20 years or so, I've been working with a group of folks here in Pennsylvania on better understanding the migration of northern saw-whet owls, which are the smallest owl that we have in the east. They're about the size of a can of soda. I used to tell people that was my favorite bird, and then a couple of years ago, I got sucked into snowy owl research, mm-hmm. and I have to tell you, there is something particularly magical about working with snowy owls. You know, they're so big and so arresting and so charismatic, and we actually know surprisingly little about their winter ecology when they're down here from the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And so, with a large number of colleagues, we've been working for the last number of winters through something called Project Snowstorm, putting these high-tech GPS GSM transmitters on snowy owls, transmitters that are using two technologies most people are carrying around in their pocket right now. They mm-hmm. communicate with GPS satellites overhead and log incredibly precise latitude and longitude and altitude locations, and then every couple of days they dial up through the cell phone network and send us a text message with all of the data. It's an amazing mm-hmm. marriage of modern technologies working with wildlife research.
In some years, not every year, but we're just far enough north that some snowies will blow down here and they'll end up, say, along Lake Erie and some of the national parks up there or even a little bit further south, but not every year. So what is it that makes sometimes their range push farther south some winters than others?
Well, I mean, most winters there's at least a couple of snowy owls that make it down to Lake Erie and, as you say, along the northern lakeshore there in Ohio. But yes, every couple of years, usually about every 4 or 5 years, you'll get a major push of snowy owls coming down. And we saw just a massive, what are known as eruptions, a massive eruption of snowy owls in the winter of 2013-2014. Mm-hmm. And those really big eruptions are usually tied to peaks in the lemming population up in the Arctic, you know, these little furry rodents that the snowy owls love to feed on during the summer. And the peak in the lemming population draws in large numbers of snowy owls from across the Arctic. They breed in great number and with great productivity. And then many of those young owls come south the following winter. And, you know, the winter of 2013-2014, there were thousands and thousands of snowy owls across the Great Lakes and the Northeast. The following winter, there were good numbers, although not quite as many, and many of those owls were second-year birds. They were in their second migration, birds that had come south the previous year. Then you occasionally will get winters where you have generally much, much smaller numbers of snowy owls pushing south. Some of the birds in these smaller eruptions can be fairly thin, and those are probably movements that are triggered by a lack of prey up in the Arctic.
And, you know, the discussion of immature or mature raptors brings up a question that you would be an authority on, which is the great debate between raptor biologists and enthusiasts, myself being, in fact, an enthusiast thereof, between the relative merits of Cape May Point, New Jersey, and Hawk Mountain, Pennsylvania. Because, for instance, my family's gone 31 Octobers in a row to Cape May and driven right by Hawk Mountain, because my wife's like, we're not stopping at Hawk Mountain, we're going to Cape May. And of course, the other way is true too. You see somebody on the Hawk Watch platform in New Jersey and they've got on a Hawk Mountain shirt. They're like, yeah, don't even start with me. These are a bunch of newbie birds. They don't even know what they're doing down here. Tell a bit about Scott.
I have to tell you, I am badly, badly biased on this, having grown up not all that far from Hawk Mountain and currently serving as the vice chair of the Hawk Mountain Board of Directors.
So there you go.
You're not going to get an unbiased opinion from me. The fact of the matter is, anywhere you watch hawks is great. What Hawk Mountain's claim to fame, though, is that, you know, as we like to say, it's the mother church of raptor conservation. In 1934, it was the world's first sanctuary for birds of prey, at a time when even most professional ornithologists and most professional conservationists didn't really like hawks very much. So, you know, we take pride of place up at Hawk Mountain. But the fact of the matter is there is a real joy in it sitting on the platform at Cape May. And, I mean, Cape May gets a whole lot more falcons than we do up on the ridges. But we do better on golden eagles and goshawks. So go to both places and enjoy the raptors wherever you are.
And, you know, both are a great example that while it's fun to go all the way to the Amazon or the Serengeti, right here in eastern North America, there is remarkable natural history and natural life all around us. But a bit, because you really would know about it, my take is on the shoreline, say in that case Cape May, you do get mostly first-year birds that get blown to the coast. And once they know what they're doing after a year or two, they stick to the ridges. Is that accurate?
Well, and certainly you see a lot more young birds along the coast, and I'm not sure if it's because they get blown there, although I suspect that's part of it, but also, you know, if you watch Doppler radar at night in the fall, you just see that there are massive numbers of songbirds moving down along the coasts. So it may be, if I were a young, dumb, relatively inexperienced sharp-shinned hawk, and my instinct just sort of drove me to the coast, there's a good chance that I'm going to find a lot more to eat and probably have a better chance of surviving than if I'm staying up in the ridges. But yes, when the birds are older, you know, there's a higher proportion of adult birds moving down the ridges, basically taking a shortcut, taking the most direct route on their way south by following those northeast to southwest Appalachian ridges and you know, coasting along on the deflection currents that the northwest winds provide when they hit the side of the mountain. So even the raptors are equal opportunity when it comes to, you know, the Cape May versus Hawk Mountain divide.
That's right. It's a win-win for everybody except a yellow-rumped warbler.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Well, this will be fun. I appreciate you coming to Cincinnati soon to share your stories. It'll be a fun evening, and you're great to take the time to come.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Shane. I'm looking forward to coming to Cincinnati.
My guest has been Scott Wiedenthal, author of the book Living on the Wind, and soon to speak at the Cincinnati Zoo in the Barrows Conservation Lecture Series. This is Thane Maynard.